על ידי יצוי רבי יחיל מחל
Good morning, everyone. First, I'd like, on behalf of Kodol Dayanus, to express our gratitude and thanks to start your day the Torah way for hosting a new series introduced by Kodol Dayanus. Today, I'm going to discuss a case of partnerships, shutfus, that went to the courts. It wasn't a Jewish case. It went to the courts, went to the Court of Appeal as well. There was many, many interesting facets of the case, but I'm going to try and focus just on two points that came out of the ruling, the judgment. There was a property, Northampton. It was owned by a livestock company, and they were trying to market the property. For a long time, the property was on the market, they were trying to market it, and eventually they engaged an agency, which was owned, incidentally, by Reuven and Shimon, a property agency, and they asked them to market the property. The agency put the property on the market, and they tried to approach buyers, and they engaged with the prospective buyers, and the it was on the market for a very long time. Eventually, Shimon, one of the partners, he was approached by Pliny, and they were interested in buying the property. Now, Shimon, although he was engaged by the seller of the property, he made an on-the-side deal, a quiet deal with the buyer, that if the buyer buys the property and then flips it, sells it on, so whatever the uplift, if there's an uplift in the sale price, so Shimon will get a third of the uplift. Shimon's partner, Reuven, had no idea about this agreement between the two of them. But, fine, so they went ahead. Eventually the property got sold. It was sold for $2.25 million. They exchanged contracts. In between exchange and completion, out of the blue, a third party approached the buyer, and they asked, inquired about this property they were buying, and they agreed to buy it for £5 million. Now, the buyer did not yet own the property, he'd only exchanged, but they went ahead with the negotiations, and on the day of completion between the buyer, the seller, and the buyer flipped the property for £5 million. So that left Shimon, the partner in the agency, the estate agency, with the small sum of £744,000 odd in commission. Because again, Shimon's deal with the buyer was that he's going to take a third of the uplift. So everyone was very happy. Till people found out. When the seller found out that Shimon, the partner in the agency, had made a deal with the buyer, so the seller sued the agency, actually, and Shimon, on a whole bunch of reasons, many, many grounds. There's negligence, breach of trust, but what we're going to focus on, and which was eventually ruled on in the court case, was they were found liable on two parts. The first one is breach of fiduciary duty, which for the solicitors here, I'm sure they know what that means. I'll explain in a moment. And the second one was vicarious liability. So let's go step by step. Vicarious liability. Let's go step by step. Let's forget those two terms, and let's just try to analyze what Shimon did here. Mitzad halacha. Shimon was engaged by the seller to sell the property. He should have been working for the seller. Instead, he was working as well for the buyer. Is there anything wrong with that? In halacha. Conflict of interest, kneves das. Okay. Where does conflict of interest, is there such a musig as conflict of interest in halacha? We do find it in various places, but let's pinpoint on a sale. How would conflict of interest impact if someone's working as an agent for a seller? Kneves das. So what would you mean by gneivas das? The same idea as conflict of interest. Because I'm meant to be working for the seller, and I'm really working for the buyer, so I'm stealing his das. So let's see if we can find sources for these two things, if they exist in halacha. Now, what is clear in halacha that we can obligate someone for damages. Yes, if someone breaks your window, you can take him to Beis Din. Someone crashes into you, deliberately or even undeliberately, you can take him to Beis Din. You can claim for damages. In such a case, where you say there's conflict of interest, gneivas das, you have to define where is the loss been. Where is there a loss for the seller? No loss. It may be unrealized profits.
No, because you can sell it to the first buyer at the low price that you can sell it for, no profit is going to make when it's
split. So you're pointing out like this, that the buyer, the agent, is marketing the property to a certain sum. Now, if he knows that he's going to get a third of the uplift, So ideally for him, he should sell it for £1, and then he'll get a lot of money if he sells it for 5 million. So we can say that perhaps the agent marketed for too low a price. Perhaps he undersold the property. And in a case where he didn't. So what was very unique about this case and this judgment was... He told him he's marketing it at 2.25, but perhaps he could have marketed it for more. He took his advice that he could market it for 2.25, but maybe he could have sold it for 3. Because even if he's happy, you're misleading him, Gnevis Das, and you're underselling the property because this agent is underselling the property because he wants to make it take a bigger cut. So the truth is that this case was a very, very unique case. What's interesting is in a judgment, when a judge issues a judgment, so he has to write a whole packle of notes. First of all, there's a whole history of the case. And then he has to write every tzad that he had about why he didn't judge like this and why he didn't judge like that. In the history of this case, it was very unique circumstances. There was a lot of local politics involved that it was very difficult to shift the land. I don't know if it interests anyone, but the land was designated as a livestock auction site, and the only way to really make money out of it was to redevelop into different. But because some of the farmers owned the property, so they were fighting against the rezoning, it was a very complicated political issue. So technically, the only way to do it was to shift the property to different owners, and once it was on different owners, then you could maybe remarket it. There was no one interested in getting involved in it. And at the time of the sale, there was only one prospective buyer. Who? This buyer. Now, when did he start working for the other side? This agent, when did he start violating his trust? When did he start having this conflict of interest? No, before. As soon as he agreed to work for the seller, that's when the conflict of interest arises. Now, at that time, in this unique case, there was no other prospective buyers. They tried with this one, they tried with that one. 2.25 was considered a normal price. Perhaps he could have raised it up to 2.5 million. Perhaps, and that's even iffy. But let's talk about a different case. Let's talk about a case where he definitely undersold it. A different case. Where an agent was working and he definitely, deliberately undersold it. The property sold for £1 million, and he undersold for 750 because he got a kickback from the seller, whatever the case may be. Do we find the source in halacha that to obligate someone? Because over here it's unrealized profits. Again, there's not a loss necessarily. It's an unrealized profit. You could have sold your property for more. We have sources in halacha for damaging someone, but not for unrealized profits. So there's a Gemara in Bava Metzia. There's a Gemara in Bava Metzia in Dafayin Gimel on the base, which is actually in the middle of Ezeim Neshach, in the middle of the Sugyos of Ribis. And the Gemara talks about an agent. There was a Meshaleach sent a Shaleach, principal sent an agent. He asked him to please go buy for him some wine from the Shuk. He gave him money. Excuse me. He gave him money, and he told him to go buy the wine. The agent was lazy, and he didn't go buy the wine. Says the Gemara that because the agent didn't go buy the wine, the agent is obligated to pay the meshaleach, the principal, the price of how he could have sold the wine, a parvasa de Zilshvat, how he could have sold it at the port of Zilshvat, which was where the wine used to go for a very high price. So it's quite an interesting idea. Because again, there's no losses. The Meshaleach did not manage to realize his profits. He could have earned a lot of money from his wine sale, and he didn't. He could have made a very good wine deal, and he didn't. Nevertheless, we say that the agent is mechuyev, is obliged to pay the full extent of the lost profit, of the unrealized profit. So says that the Rishonim will ask, how could that be? So the Ritvan, he goes with an explanation that because the Meshaleach, the principal, relied on the agent to do something for him, to do the deal, and he gave him money and he fully relied on him that he's going to do that, there's an arvus, as it were, a guarantor against all the unrealized profits. And the agent was taking it upon himself that if he causes that the profits cannot be realized, if he's the cause of this, by him being lazy or negligent, then he will compensate and he will account for all the unrealized profits towards the owner. The Nesidus goes with this, La Halacha, in a couple of places. He explains a few different cases in Shulchan Aruch. There's a big tumul in the Achroinim, how to understand this sugya of a pazap, or this wine in Zol Shvat. But the practice among contemporary Batei Din is to go with this Mahalach. That means that if you appoint someone, or you rely on someone to do a deal for you, and they're negligent, then they have to account for the lost profits. Not for all of it, but we bring it into account, towards a pshara, whatever the case may be. But that's only in a case where there's a definite loss. That's only in a case where for sure there was unrealized profits. back to our case of this livestock auction site, it wasn't unrealized profits. It was totally unclear that he couldn't have got any more money for the site. Maybe £250,000 more, perhaps. But to make the agent, the Shimon, mechuyev to pay account for all his profits from this underhand deal to account to the seller, it doesn't make any sense. The term in civil law is a breach of fiduciary duty. Fiduciary duty means that whenever someone's engaged by any party, be it a director of a company, be it an agent, be it an employee, his care of duty is fully towards his employer, his company, or his mishaleach, whoever it may be. And he has to do that. Now, in order shaloi heichoita niska, as it were, that we can't let the person who's in breach of such fiduciary duty, we can't let the person who's in breach of trust earn any money. So it evolved that the courts would oblige him to pay, he would account all his profits. Now, technically, all the profits could go to Tzedakah, or Beti Eit HMRC. But they probably realized that if you have to account profits to HMRC, no one will be very happy. So the law came into place that any breach of trust makes it as if the person is not there at all. The person who's in breach of trust is not even there. And any profits he makes from that sale, or from that deal, whatever it may be, he has to account to the originator. So back to our case. The agent was in breach of fiduciary trust. He has to make profits from that breach, even though the profits could not have been realized by the seller in any which fashion. Nevertheless, because he's in breach, they have to be accounted towards the seller. That's the civil law, and that's how they ruled. Now, the second issue we have to know here is that the seller sued the company, the agency. And not only did they sue the agency, they sued individually the two partners in the agency, Reuven and Shimon. Shimon was the one who did the underhanded deal. But the company sued Reuven because he was a partner. Now, this law is very, very far-reaching.
They're suing him for the 700,000, isn't it?
744,000. They can't sue him for the whole lot. They can't sue him for the whole lot because they've got no grounds. They can only sue him for the breach of trust. That means that if Shimon would have let the agency know that the buyer's also trying to, he let the sellers know that the buyer's also trying to engage with him, and he would have informed them and they would have agreed, then nothing would have happened. But because he did it under the table, that's where the problems arose. But again, it's only for the £744,000. The truth is that originally they tried to sue him for the whole 2.75, but they dropped the charges eventually because they realized it wouldn't get anywhere, so they only focused on the 744. Now, so what is it? Can you sue the partner for the losses?
Is it a partnership, not a company?
Excellent. So the Partnership Act of 1890, believe it or not, which is...
Joint and several.
So the Partnership Act of the partnership, all partnerships in England are governed by an act from 1890. Go figure. The Partnership Act starts off that this is only liable to partnerships which are not liable under company law. So if under company law. It means you have to understand what the situation is, how the company was set up, how the firm was set up, whether it's defined as a company or defined as a partnership. So we're going to put companies at the side, we're going to focus on the partnerships. And here it was clearly defined as a partnership. How do you define a partnership? So if we look at the law is quite clear that most partnerships, solicitors informed me that it's not all partnerships, but it's most partnerships, are all defined as a separate entity. If you look through the law, it keeps on talking about the firm. So even though they're not considered a company as governed under the Company Act, but they're considered a partnership and governed under the Partnership Act, but it's a separate entity. The two partners, or however many partners, fuse together to create the firm. And the firm is liable. It's got rights and it's got obligations. In halacha, there's no such thing as a separate entity company. Not necessarily. I'm saying maybe Klapi Ribis, certain things, but in shutfus, there's no such thing. When two people engage in a partnership, in a shutfus, they can become jointly, they become joined together in certain business relationships, but they don't become a separate entity. Partnerships in halacha are made up of an amalgamation of schirus poelim, that they're hired workers, there's shibudim, there's certain obligations that one takes upon themselves, and there's shlichus as well, there's agents and proxies, and there's proxies and principals. One partner sends the other partner to do something, he's sending an agent on his behalf, a shliach. But there's no entity as a partnership. So each time we talk about a shutfus, we have to analyze, are we talking about schirus poelim, are we talking about hiring workers, are we talking about that they're joint owners of something. So let's analyze certain different types of partnerships. Before we analyze this, let's just look at an interesting point in the law, in the civil law, about how partnerships work. The partnership law in section 10 says that it discusses this point of vicarious liability, which is the responsibility of one partner for the wrongdoings of the other. And it's kedai to just mention a point where it says, by any wrongful act or omission of any partner acting in the ordinary course of business of the firm, if loss or injury is caused to another, any person not being a partner, then the firm is liable. So again, the law defines that the firm is liable because of the wrongdoings of one of the partners. An extreme case is a case of Dubai Aluminium. Dubai Aluminium, which is obviously a company which is based in Dubai, which sells aluminium, it's a huge company. It's owned by the government, I think. And there was a group of fraudsters who got together and managed to defraud the company out of $50 million. And they did this through sham contracts. And when the company found out, they sued the whole group. One of the parties they sued, was a firm of solicitors, because one of the partners in the firm of solicitors was drawing up these sham contracts. And the case went through the regular courts, the Court of Appeal, until the House of Lords, and the House of Lords ruled that the whole firm is liable. Why? Because the solicitor who was drawing up the sham contracts was engaged in ordinary acts of business. A solicitor's job is to draw up contracts. It's not his ordinary course of business to defraud people. But on the other hand, the drawing up the contracts was normal. So Mela, the courts held, the Lord of the House of Lords held, so the whole firm is liable. Yeah. Now, in Halacha, that's not the case. Let's take a classical shutfus. What's a classical shutfus? If we go into a partnership together and we buy either goods, property, let's say. So the goods, as soon as we put in our money into the partnership, we put our things, money together in one purse, we agree on a certain proportion how we're going to own the schir that we're buying or the house that we're buying. If there's no proportion agreed, it's 50-50. But let's say you agree to proportion, you put in the money, as soon as you buy it, so you jointly own the house. And you jointly own the goods. So whether the goods or the house goes up in value or down in value, you will jointly gain or jointly lose. But not because I'm obligated for what yenem lost, because I own part of something which is going up. I own an asset which is going up and down in value. Now, that's all talking about where we're talking about the property, we're talking about goods, where there's something tangible and physical that we can discuss and assess. Can you have a partnership in a services business? A service business. Sorry?
Two lawyers, two tailors,
an estate agent, a service business. Now, you're not buying anything physical. You're not joining in together and buying anything physical which is going to go up and down in value. You've made a commitment to each other that any profits which either of you make, any money which either of you make, you'll agree to split it at a certain proportion. But where does the obligation come in that? So the Shulchan Aruch in the beginning of Siman Kuf Ayin Vav, which is the Siman and Chosh Mishpah Kuf Ayin Vav, which is the Siman which deals in Shutfus, cites the Machlokes as Machlokes Rambam and Ravid. It's actually a four-way Machlokes. If Umonim, craftsmen, can they enter into a partnership? There's a four-way machlokes whether you do need a kenyan, you don't need a kenyan. It's also a dovah shaloi bal olam. It's not yet in existence. I can't sell you apples which have not yet grown. Because in order to transfer ownership of anything, you need to have an act of acquisition, a ma'aseh kenyan. If I want to give you my car, you can either do a chalipin on the car, we can give an exchange type of kenyan, where I give you my handkerchief and you'll give me your car. If it's a small object, we can do hagbah, we can lift up the object, a meshicha. But on something which is not yet in existence in the world, you can't have a ma'aseh kinyan. You can't have an act of acquisition. You can't own it. So how do two partners who are engaged in a service business obligate themselves to give the money over to each other? So there's four mahalchim in the Rishonim. We're not going to discuss that. There's four different shittas in the Rishonim. Either that it taka doesn't work. Either that it works for only money which has already come into the shutfus. Once the money comes in and we agree, and we carry on to agree the arrangement, then the money happens, but we can break up the partnership at any time. Some say that it does work, because shutfus is something different. That's not our discussion. Al Kolponim, that's talking about future profits. What about future losses? It's reasonable to expect that a tailor who is engaged in repairing suits, one out of a number of suits that he repairs will get damaged. It's a reasonable assumption. So can one partner oblige themselves, say that when you damage a suit, when you second partner damage a suit, I will pay you for the damages. I will bear the damages as much as you. We're not being makne anything, we're being mischayev. We're not giving over, we're taking upon ourselves an obligation. Does that work? So there is types, there is mechanisms in halacha for this. A person can say, there's aravos, yes, a guarantor on a loan. How does that work? When Reuven gives Shimon money, Levi says, I'm going to take upon myself that if Shimon doesn't pay you back, I'll pay you. That's aravos, a guarantor. There is such types of kinyonim. But such types of kinyonim are limited, and you have to see whether it's his chayvus, whether it's an obligation, whether it's an aravos, a guarantor, and to what extent you can use those kinyonim. How far can you take it? It makes sense that you can take it on two tailors who are partners together, that one tailor will oblige himself for the losses incurred by the other tailor. But to take it further than that, that I'm going to take upon myself any loss that you do, any damage that happens to you, it's very difficult to understand. In the case, our case, back to the property case, the Shimon, one partner, went and did an underhanded deal against the will of his partner and was machayev him £745,000. It's very, very far reaching to say that one partner would agree to be mischayev, would agree to obligate himself to bear those losses. And even if he does, how can you do a kinyan on such a thing?
When you deal with that company, you expect the company to take a price.
Again, so the law deals with the firm, and the law, the reasoning given by the judges in various cases is exactly as you're saying. How did the extent of vicarious liability come in? How did this concept come in? Because in the normal course of business, it's expected there's going to be a loss. And Nebuch, this poor fellow, he's lost money. How is he going to recoup his losses? So therefore, we have to obligate the firm. And not only that, the law goes even further. In one of the judgments, it says you have to be expected that if you tell an employee to do something, he might directly disobey you as well. So you have to take on those losses. That doesn't make any sense. It's very nice for the customer's lost money that now he's got somewhere to claim from. But if I tell my employee, please don't do anything wrong, and he goes and does something wrong, then I'm a chuyv. Take an extreme example. There's an insurance agent, and he's an insurance broker, and he's trying to bring in more contracts. So he employs someone, and he says, please, can you go bring me new contracts? So this fellow comes, and he's bringing him new contracts. Many, many new insurance people come to take out insurance. Eventually he finds out, how did this fellow bring in so many new contracts to insurance? Because he threatened to break people's knees. So, I'm obligated, they're going to take, and if he did break people's knees? So I have to pay for those damages? More than that, if I tell someone to go beat someone up, if I tell Reuven, go beat up Shimon, Shimon can't take me to the Tintayra. I'm Potter, Ein Shliach L'Dvar Aveira. He shouldn't have listened to me. I told Reuven to beat Shimon up, Reuven shouldn't have listened to me, he knows better. It doesn't make sense, logically in halacha, it does not make sense to be mechayev someone for the wrongdoings of another. I tell him specifically, don't do something wrong, it goes to something wrong. Go on. But in halacha, there's no such thing as a group. There's two individual people who are engaged in a partnership.
Yeah, but the outsider has engaged the partnership.
No, so in halacha, that's not the case. In halacha, you haven't engaged the partnership. You've engaged Reuven and Shimon.
Yeah, what I was saying is that the outsider should be able to take an action against whatever the group is. Within the group, if someone's done something wrong, then one can sue the other.
That's true in law. That's true in law. Yeah. That you can sue the firm and the one partner can sue the firm. But in halacha, there's no firm. You can't sue the wall. It doesn't exist.
Is there enough
given that
there's a written partnership agreement or there's a non-written?
No. Partnership agreement doesn't have to be written. As long as the partnership starts off on those engaged terms, on those terms, then it's true. In civil law, it's the same. There's no difference between a written agreement and a verbal agreement. Yeah. As long as the partnership is going ahead on those terms. So when can you obligate someone for losses? There's one case where we could... Where we could bring a dimion, perhaps. The case was someone that bought a stolen object. There were two partners engaged in schayra, buying and selling goods, and one of the partners bought a stolen object. So the halacha is like this. A partner bought a stolen object. Let's go back previously. Yeah. Let's go a step before this. The halacha is that obviously a partner has to engage according to that. Each partner has to work towards the shutfus according to the terms of agreement. If a partner goes against the shutfus, it's shino. It changes. What's the halacha? So let's bring a castle case. It's forbidden to trade in nevedas or treifas. You can't trade in treif animals, treif food. Now, what happens if one of the partners did engage in such trade? The halacha is that if there's a profit, the profit needs to be split, and if there's a loss, the partner who engaged in the illegal trade, as it were, the analachic trade, he has to bear all the losses. Well, so where the partner knows about it could be different. Where the partner knows about it could be different. Let's talk about the case of a stolen goods we sold earlier. One partner knowingly bought stolen goods and sold them on, and he made a profit. So the halacha is like this. If the partner, if there's a loss, the partner who bought the stolen goods has to bear all the loss. If there's a profit, he has to split it. So they did that, they split the profits, and the person who didn't deal in the stolen goods also took part of the profit, and then came the fine. Then they got fined. So how do you split the fine? So the Rama says that you split the fine. Because he took half the profits, he has to take half the loss as well. It's a matter of contention. Most of the poskim say that when you deal in stolen, as soon as a person deals in stolen goods, he's in it by himself. It breaks the partnership, but there's no way you bring this into the partnership. It's gone. But that's the only case we find in halacha which is similar to this case. So to extend this concept of vicarious liability to such an extent to obligate Reuven, who had no idea that Shimon made this underhanded deal for the property, is very, very far. The truth is that partnerships and hashutfas and halacha is very, very complicated. And anyone who's gone to a partnership knows that usually when people go into partnership, they assume that everything's going to be plain sailing, and they're going to make lots of money together. The problems arise when it doesn't happen that way, where it's not plain sailing or there's losses. So the way to prevent problems arising, of course you can't prevent every single problem arising, otherwise I wouldn't be standing here, the way to prevent such a situation arising is obviously try and get an honest partner, and you to be transparent with your partners. You be honest, obviously, be elech, because the halacha demands from people to be elech. There's care of duty, you have to do things in good faith. Everything has to be done properly. And as we say, most important is to have an agreement. Have a partnership agreement, a written agreement. And just like you don't sell a house without a solicitor, you don't sell a house on the back of an envelope, so you don't make a partnership agreement on the back of an envelope in between Mincha Maariv. You have to get guidance how to do it, and especially there can be suri derisa if one doesn't put a partnership agreement correctly. Ribis, if one partner borrows and the other partner has to pay back, it could be ribis, it's isa derisa. So it's very, very important to have a partnership agreement. And to go with the Shulchan Aruch, to go gleich. Emet Hashem and b'schus that, we should have a surus toivus.